of the typical critiques against orthodoxy is that people see the limitations and the rules within halacha as something that opposes or is against individuality or creativity or the like. So, of course, I don't think that's the case. There are, of course, limitations, but that's...
But it's certain compliance.
Exactly. This summer, I was visiting my mother, my parents, and there was this TV show that my mother likes very much called The Iron Chef. Heard of it? Seen it? So I thought that was a perfect analogy, because in The Iron Chef, you need to, you're very limited. You have only a certain ingredients, and you have to present something, to prepare something with these specific ingredients. So even though there are a lot of limitations, but there's still a lot of room for creativity. The fact that there are limitations doesn't in and of itself preclude the possibility of creativity. So anyway, that's what we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about does orthodoxy oppose creativity? And specifically, we're going to talk about it within the context of the golden calf, which is this week's parsha. This week's parsha is Parshas Kisisa. And we read about the sin of the golden calf. The sin of the golden calf, of course, is one of the most perplexing episodes in Torah. It's so perplexing because how could it be that a mere 40 days after Matan Torah, national revelation, all the miracles of Yetzias Mitzrayim and the like, the Jewish people stray so far so quickly? How could they question or deny God, serve idolatry and the like after having experienced all that they experienced? And that is, of course, a question that many have asked and many have answered. And I think that serves as a springboard for our discussion. So first of all, we'll start with some basic Mekoros, and then we'll talk about the Egel Hazav, and then we'll go back to the question in general. This is a topic which you could spend many, many hours discussing, and certainly we will not be able to consider all the nuances and the history of this question, but we'll start off with a couple of interesting sources. The Gemara on the top right in Brachos 58a says, Tana Rabbanan haroa uchluse Yisrael, Omer baruch chacham harazim, shein datam domin dome zelazeh, vein partzufehem domin zelazeh. If you see a large crowd of Jews, more than 600,000 people. Anyone ever seen more than 600,000 people in one place?
Of Jews,
yeah. even non-Jews, I don't even think I've ever seen. So, it's not too common. Anyhow, if you do, so you say a bracha, and the bracha is, blessed is God who discerns secrets. Why? Because what is so extraordinary is there is this huge crowd of people, hundreds of thousands of people, and each one of them is different. They look different, they think differently, they are different. And the Torah celebrates this differentiation, this individuality. Everyone is different and is supposed to look different and they think differently. And this is something which is positive. It's something which is celebrated. We make a bracha in recognition of this incredible feat. As the Mishnah and Sanhedrin on Daf Lamed Zion, the next source, indicates, that normally if a person were to make a coin, for example, say they would use a mold to make a coin, and if a single mold is used, so then every coin is identical or nearly identical. Whereas when it comes to humans, everybody came from Adam and Chava, they came from the same mold, and yet everyone is different. And the Mishnah tells us the significance of that difference. For example, one of the lessons derived from that is that one person cannot say to the other, I have better yichus than you, I'm more important than you, because we all go back to the same yichus. Also, we derive every single person can say Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, because the world was created for a single person. But for our purposes, the Mishnah stresses this idea that everyone is different, everyone is unique. Kashem Sheparzufehem Shonin Kach Deosehen Shonin. Just as they look differently, so too they think differently. And another place where we see this diversity celebrated is in the Gemara in Krisos, which also relates to this Parsha, so we'll mention it. The Gemara in Krisos says that there's a mitzvah to bring the ketores, the incense offering, every day in the Beis HaMikdash, as we read at the beginning of this week's Parsha, Parshas Kisisa. And one of the ingredients in the incense offering is the chelbana, galbanum. Apparently, chelbana does not smell very good. And yet, it's included in the incense offering, and clearly the incense offering is meant to be a sweet aroma. It's supposed to smell good. So the Talmud derives from here that just as we have to include this chelbana in the ketores, so too we have to include sinners in a public fast. This is actually the reason why before Yom Kippur we say Anu matirin lispala l'mavaryanim. We go ahead and anyone who may have been excommunicated, we welcome them back. We ask them to join us because our prayer services would be incomplete without them. And the Ran, in Drashos HaRan, interprets this in a fascinating way. He writes about that the importance of including all different types of people. And his theory is that when you have diversity, when you have different types of people, then the community as a whole will achieve moderation. If everyone was the same, then individuals tend towards the extremes. He takes the idea that the Rambam stresses that we need moderation, but he applies it not so much to the individuals, the Rambam states, but rather to the community. As a community, we need moderation, and the way to achieve moderation within a community is to incorporate all different types of people. If everyone was the same, we wouldn't have that. If, for example, a community was made up entirely of people who are very cheap, so they have the vice of being stingy, so the community would never build anything. If everybody was very extravagant, so then they would never have any money. They would build without the funds to complete. If you have a mixture of people that are dreamers, but perhaps not so financially responsible, you have people that are a little too stingy, and you put them together, then you'll have a community, and he applies this to other midos as well, which is much more powerful.
It also contributes to greater creativity.
Mm-hmm. In what sense?
Diversity of views.
Exactly.
And as a matter of fact, the place I used to work, they would kind of go out of their way to emphasize this and to encourage people to speak out, because it doesn't do us, if you think you're not sure about your views and whether they're worthwhile, and maybe I ought to be quiet and show deference to the people who are more the leaders, that is not encouraged.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, in the book about the state of Israel's economy, I think that was called
Startup Nation.
Mm-hmm. It emphasized the diversity and bottom-up critique of each other.
Yep. So you find that a lot in learning. That's one in the Sanhedrin, Poschen Menatzad. That's why the senior judges don't start with their opinion. The most junior judges speak first. You find the Marsha writes. That's one of the reasons why we learn with Chavrusas. Because if you learn by yourself, so you only have your perspective. If you learn in a group, so you have multiple perspectives. And there's a beautiful passage from Rav Kook. Rav Kook writes, the Talmud says, we say frequently, that Talmidei Chachamim bring shalom to the world. So he says, what do you mean Torah scholars bring shalom? There's always arguing with each other. There's so much machlokas. Every single Gemara you see, There's a machlokes, one opinion says asur, one opinion says mutter, tamei tar, where's the shalom? Shalom is peace. So he says, no. Peace doesn't mean everybody says the same thing and does the same thing. Shalom is like from the word shalem, which means whole, complete. You only have completeness when you have the diversity and the various perspectives. As long as everybody is saying the same thing, so you, that might lead to an absence of machlokes, but it's not shalom, because it's not shalem. So, that's exactly the idea. And there are many avenues in which, within the service of God, our creativity is stressed. Individuality is stressed. The Rambam here, on the bottom of page, bottom right of page 1, talks about the Mishnah, Ratza Kodesh Baruch Hu Lezakos Es Yisrael Afikach Hirbalam Torah Mitzvos, that God wanted to bring merit to the Jewish people, and therefore he gave them so many mitzvot, 613 mitzvot. So the Rambam says, in what way is it a zechus? Maybe it would be more of a merit if we only had 3 mitzvot. That way we could make sure to do them all. And the Rambam answers, this is because a person naturally tends to particular things. And while, of course, everyone has to do every single mitzvah, but we tend to specialize, and every person could do one mitzvah perfectly well. For some people it might be tzedakah, for some it might be chesed, for some it might be tefillah, for some it might be Talmud Torah. I was just thinking about, there's this person in the minyan I daven in the morning, and anytime he sees someone whose tefillin are not either straight or they're too big, many people don't put on their shel rosh correctly, so he very kindly and gently, not in a way that somebody would feel is offensive, offers to tighten them and fix them and to show them, and if they need paint, he paints it for them. And I'm just thinking, you know, over the years, how many thousands of people he's helped. I'm not saying that's his only mitzvah, but what an amazing thing. There's a person who, an older gentleman who audits one of my classes in YU, and his mitzvah, once he asked to make a presentation to the class on this Shiluach HaKein, he knows everything about Shiluach HaKein, and a person could, at the very least, you know, we have to try to do all the mitzvahs, but one mitzvah we could do perfectly, and because there's so many different types of mitzvahs, and there's so many different types of people, so everybody could always find one mitzvah. And he writes, Lachain Amar Rabbi Chanina, Ki machmas ribuy ha-mitzvos, i'afshar shelo yase adam achas, b'chol yimei chayev b'shleimush, v'yizka l'hash'arus ha-nefesh b'oso maisa. Because there are so many mitzvos, it's impossible that a person not at least do one mitzvah, one time in his life, absolutely perfectly, and thereby merit eternality. And it's interesting, the Ramban points out, even when people are doing the same mitzvah, but they could do it differently. You could have 100 people doing the same mitzvah, but each of them has a different kavanah, and it means something different. The Ramban makes this point concerning the donations and the sacrifices of the Nesiim in Parshas Naso. If anyone ever lay in Parshas Naso, you'll know that it's very, very long and very, very repetitive. It says the same thing again and again, 12 times. They all brought the exact same thing. And it takes dozens and dozens of psukim to tell you, Karbana, oh, Karaskasa Vachas, right? It tells you 12 times. Why didn't it just say, the following 12 people brought the following gift, and say it once? Why repeat it again and again? And the Ramban answers, Va'od bezet tam acher b'midrasham, ki l'chol echad me'an nesiyim ala b'machshava lavi chanuka l'mizbeach, v'shetia bezet shior. Aval nachshon chashav b'shir zeh tam echad v'zulaso kol echad me'anisim chashav tam b'fnei atmo. Even though they ended up bringing the same thing, but each one had a different kavana. So there were 12 identical gifts, but when Nachshon had his gift in mind, he did it for one reason, and when the second Nasi had his gift, he had a different intention, and the third one had a third intention. It's just like if you have a shul. Everybody might be shaking Arba Minim, but one person might have kavanos, mystical intentions while shaking it, and another person might be thinking L'shem Mitzvah, and another person might be thinking about Arba Ruchos and how God encompasses the world. there are so many different kavanos that are plausible even with a single observance of a single mitzvah. And that's the reason for the repetition, because it wasn't the same thing for everybody. Physically, it might have been identical, but the thoughts that were behind it were by no means identical. There are many expressions of individuality and creativity. One, the bottom of page one on the left, Zekeli Banveu Hisna Lafanav B'mitzvos, the concept of Hidur Mitzvah, which tells us that one should beautify mitzvos. How one does that? There are no rules, there's no Shulchan Aruch. A person does it as they see fit. When it comes to prayer, even if we all have to say the same Shemona Esrei, however, there's room for individuality. Firstly, a person should insert their own petitions. When I need a particular thing, so I should add that either to the appropriate bracha, or to Shema Kolenu, or Elokai Neshamat, the end. If I wish, I should express my gratitude, not just for the things that everybody says, but for the personal blessings that I receive in my life. So it's not even true that we all should say the same thing. We should incorporate our own elements, personal elements, into the tefillah. But even beyond that, the Zohar writes a fascinating thing. The Zohar is talking here about tefillah betzibur. And tefillah betzibur, public prayer, is really a remarkable and somewhat surprising concept. Why? Because tefillah is something which is an intimate encounter with the divine. It's a personal conversation with God. That's the reason why Shemona Esrei is recited silently. And if it is so intimate, why is it that we do it publicly? What is the advantage of praying with a minyan? So that's one answer, and that's absolutely correct. But is it more than that? And there are, of course, many elements to this. Tefillah betzibur eina nemeses. When I daven with the tzibur and I publicly declare my belief in God, so the public declaration, as the Ramban writes, is something that's very powerful. We all do it together. It's also helpful.
From the Ketusha, mm-hmm. Mandated.
Exactly, so. Exactly. But the Zohar, I think, adds a element which is very powerful. I'll read it to you here in English. The Hebrew is here as well, the Aramaic. The prayer of a congregation ascends to the Holy One, blessed be He, and He is crowned therewith, because it comprises many hues and directions. Wherefore, it is made into a crown and placed on the head of the Righteous One, the Living One of the worlds. The prayer of the individual, however, is not many-sided and presents only one hue. The Zohar, of course, speaks very poetically, and it compares the prayer of an individual to the prayer, which is a single color. My prayer, as it were, might be green, yours might be blue, yours might be red, yours might be yellow. It has a single facet to it. When all of us come together and pray, so all of our prayers, as it were, join together to create this magnificent crown comprised of all the colors, and, as it were, to place it upon God. It's precisely because our prayers are different that when they join together, they are so powerful. If it were the case that all of our prayers, or all of us, were the same, if all of our prayers were green, as it were, so then there would be nothing accomplished by tefillah betzibur. It's precisely because of our differences that tefillah betzibur is so powerful. And certainly within the realm of Torah study, individuality is something which is frequently stressed. The halacha is, Ein adam lomei Torah ela mimakom shelibo chafetz. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah says that a person should study Torah from the place which he enjoys. Now, of course, a person must study all of Torah, but one can specialize. The Radvaz here in a tshuva writes, the reason for this is, Ki behabit adam el misha da'ato nochebo, nafsho misoreres ela kavana hashlema, v'da'ato misracheves, v'libo sameach, v'nacha lav az ruach Hashem. If we study something which we don't enjoy, we all know it's much harder to retain. If we could be excited by it, and it electrifies us. So then we will much, there's a much greater chance that we'll internalize it. It'll stick with us. Another element of individuality in Torah study is the concept of a chiddush. The highest form of Torah study is to come up with something new. Now, a chiddush, something chadash, something new, is of course paradoxical. On the one hand, we believe that all Torah comes from Sinai, from God through Moshe. And yet there's this concept of innovation within Torah. The Yerushalmi in Chagiga highlights this paradox. It says, Kol Masha Talmud Vasik Asid Lahoros Nemar Lamosha Misinai, or some have the Girsa Asid Lachadesh Nemar Lamosha Misinai. Which of course is a paradox, because if it was already said at Sinai, then how is it a chiddush?
Yeah, how did Moshe comment on Rabbi Akiva's learning all these chidushim from the Targum and all that stuff if he already knew it at Sinai?
Absolutely.
Why was he surprised that
Rabbi Akiva
knew this? He said, oh yeah, I remember that one.
Exactly. So there are of course a number of ways to understand it. On its most basic level, the idea is that it's all rooted in the Torah that came from Sinai. And that's why he felt better when he said, this is, when Rabbi Akiva said, this is Halach L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. If it's, on the one hand, Mesorah and tradition is extremely important. If it doesn't fit in the context of tradition, so then it has no place. But at the same time, Torah is so broad that if it does genuinely fit in within the tradition, and it can, it is truly rooted in the Torah, so then, while it might be a chiddush, at the same time, it's part of the Torah which was given to Moshe at Sinai. There are two texts. It says about Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkonos. On the one hand, he says about himself, he never said anything that he hadn't received from his teachers. And at the same time, he says that he was machadesh things shelo shaman ozen misinai, it says, I think, in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer in the first or second chapter. So how are those compatible? How could he both never have said something that he didn't receive from his teachers, but at the same time have said things that had never been articulated since Matan Torah? And the answer is because if something is rooted, and again, you could give technical answers. He learned a derech from his Rebbe, which allowed him to innovate new things. But the idea is all the same, which is that if it's rooted in the tradition, in Sinai, so then even if it's novel, it can go back to Sinai, but be a chiddush. And there, again, I want to make sure we have a chance to get to the discussion of Egel Azav and see how this fits in. But this is an idea that has many, many expressions. And at the end, we'll return to some if we have a chance. With this in mind, it's not surprising, of course, that throughout our tradition, there have been many innovations. Kabbalah Shabbos, for example, was an innovation of the 15th and 16th century. Until then, there wasn't the service. Even the service was comprised, was a composition of a couple of different traditions that merged together. And now, hundreds of years later, it's nearly universal. And we could bring many such examples of innovations. And in light of what we've been saying about creativity and individuality and the like, that shouldn't be surprising. So with this in mind, we'll begin to consider some of the dangers of creativity and innovation. And we'll begin with the story in this week's Parsha, the story of the Chet HaEgel. So as we mentioned before, the Chet HaEgel is extraordinarily perplexing. Because after all, the Jewish people, a mere 40 days after having received the Torah, having experienced revelation, prophecy of some sort, go ahead and seemingly reject the Torah, reject God, and serve idolatry. So how do we understand that?
Wasn't it only a very small percentage? Was it 3,000?
So, okay, correct. So it was about 3,000. So let's say 0.5% of the adult males at the very least. Yes, indeed. But, well then, if that was it, then why didn't everybody else stone them, right? And moreover, why did Aaron participate?
Well, his participation is looked upon in different ways.
Yes, true, but he wasn't killed, and he eventually became the Kohen Gadol. So
he was afraid.
He was afraid, but it's Yarg Vel Yavor. It's true. Rashi quotes the Medrash. Yeah. He saw the death of Chor. Nachon. However, if it was Avodah Zarah, as it seems to be at first glance, it's Yarg Vel Yavor. A person must give up their life before serving idolatry, and certainly before creating an idol. And if a person doesn't do that, then we would not think highly of them. Why is it that Moshe prays for Aaron to be saved, and yet everybody else, the participants, are killed? Why is it that Aaron is known as a chassid? He was a prophet. He was the Kohen Gadol, if what he did was idolatry.
So did he really consciously and intentionally make an idol, or did he throw something into the fire? Is that
okay.
Medrash, or is that
so
taken
that
literally?
Is, so what,
came
there
out
are, that is certainly one of the motivations of these Midrashim and the like, but his participation was never, even if he didn't intend to make an idol, but he had some role. And after it was created, he says, Chag L'Hashem Achar, right? So how do we understand this? So we're going to examine tonight two similar approaches, one by the Khuzari and one by the Ramban. And similar approaches are taken, can be found in the writings of the Ibn Ezra, the Rambam, and the like. And the common denominator that all these approaches take, though they express it somewhat differently, is that this was clearly not idolatry, at least in the classical sense. And if you read the Psukim carefully, this becomes obvious. For one thing, Aaron says, for example, Chag LaHashem Machar. Hashem, Yudke Vavke. This was not a act of idolatry. What prompts them to do this sin? Exactly. They see Moshe coming, and they're looking for a replacement for Moshe. Akizem Moshe Ish, Asher Elanu Me'aretz Mitzrayim, Lo Yadanu Mehayalo. Now, they didn't think Moshe was God. And if this is a replacement for Moshe, unless you say they did, but that's...
One shot is, that's why at the end of Shalach against Amalek, to disabuse anybody of the notion that Moshe was the one responsible bringing out Mitzrayim and the miracles of the sea, it shows that his limitations and his...
Okay, great, exactly.
You know, weaknesses.
And it was clear at Matan Torah that that wasn't the case. It was absolutely clear that God was God. Moshe was a messenger of God, was a prophet of God, but he wasn't God. So they were looking for a replacement for Moshe, someone who would lead them in the Midbar. And they were understandably quite terrified. They panicked. They were in a desert, an inhospitable environment, an environment that didn't allow for natural living, certainly not for a nation of this size. They panicked, and they were looking for a replacement for Moshe, namely as an intermediary. And again, we'll see how the Khuzari expresses this, how the Ramban expresses it, but the common denominator is that they were looking for an intermediary through which the divine force could communicate or direct them. Let me give as a preface, we're not going to read it inside, but you have here on page 2 and 3 the Rambam from the beginning of Hilchos Avodah Zarah. And the Rambam here addresses an important historical question, namely, how is it that idolatry began? At one point, clearly, everybody in the world believed in God. Adam or Noach certainly believed in God. So how do we explain the evolution towards idolatry? And the Rambam answers that indeed it was an evolution of sorts. people had difficulty serving and worshiping a God that they can't see, that they can't touch, that they can't hear. Serving something that's incorporeal, that's intangible, that's seemingly abstract, is something that people naturally have a difficult time relating to, because we're physical creatures and we, generally speaking, deal with physical things. And so they sought a way to serve God which has an element of something physical. And I'm overly simplifying here. I recommend that you read it inside to get the details. But they started off, for example, with the sun. They said the sun was created by God, and in this sun we see God's might and power, because the sun is such a majestic and powerful creation. Let us go ahead and build a temple to the sun, and thereby pay tribute and homage to God. Eventually, they got so used to serving the sun that they forgot that their service of the sun was a mere intermediary. And the same thing holds true with angels and other things. So it evolved. It's not something that happened in 1 year or even one generation. People got so focused on the serving of the intermediary that they forgot that it was merely an intermediary. And essentially, the same type of mistake happens here. So you have here the Khuzari. The Khuzari is on page 4 of your sheets. And I'll read it to you in English for the time being. This is from chapter 1. We'll start from section 96. And the Khuzari, as you know, was a conversation, an imagined conversation between the king of Khazar, the Khazars, who was considering conversion. And initially there was a priest and a Muslim scholar and a philosopher and a rabbi, each one arguing for their own perspective. Actually, the rabbi wasn't initially invited because it wasn't imagined that he would have something to say. It was only after the other religions admitted that they were predicated upon the Jewish faith that the king of the Khazars thought perhaps it makes sense to actually invite a rabbi. Anyhow, we'll start in the middle. Another time perhaps we could introduce the book a little more. And the king of the Khazars says, I grant you that your nation was worthy of achieving greatness in the world, but still, how could there be any remnant of greatness after this sin of the golden calf? And the rabbi responds, in those days, every people worshipped images. Even if philosophers had been able to prove to everyone the existence of the one omnipotent God, they still would not have relinquished their images. This is because they would focus their attentions upon the image and would profess to the masses that divinity attaches itself to the image, and that it is unique in some supernatural way. Some would attribute this uniqueness directly to God. We do something like this today when we treat certain places with special reverence. We will even consider the soil and rocks of these places as sources of blessing. I think he's referring to the Gemara at the end of Ksubos that says that Rabbi Abba, when he entered the land of Israel, would kiss the stones of Akko. We know of people who, when they come off the plane the first time to Israel, so they kiss the ground. Others would attribute the image's supernatural qualities to a certain star, planet, constellation, the like. The masses would not accept upon themselves any religious teaching unless it was accompanied by some image upon which they could focus their attention. Meaning to say, like we were saying, they needed something to focus upon. Now, during this period of history, Israel was waiting for that which Moshe had promised to bring down to them from God, something that they could focus upon, just as they had focused upon the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire when they left Egypt. He seems to be adapting the position of the Ibn Ezra, that the cloud and the fire was only there initially. And the cloud and the fire was something that they could focus their attention on. They could contemplate and meditate upon a particular object and thereby associate that object with God and come to some towards a type of communion with God. And they were hoping that they would receive the Luchos, which Moshe had planned to bring down, and it would serve that purpose. And in fact, many understand that was the purpose of the images in the Mishkan, after all.
With the Mishkan itself.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So that's what they were hoping for. The Luchos, the Torah, which was next to the Luchos, would be something physical that they could focus their attention upon in the service of God. And I'm skipping a little. They waited patiently for Moshe, but at a certain time they panicked. Now here he too adopts the position of the Ibn Ezra. According to Rashi, they knew that it was going to be 40 days, but there was some sort of confusion and misunderstanding about how to calculate the 40 days. According to Kuzari and Ibn Ezra, Moshe hadn't even told them 40 days. So they were waiting for Moshe, and they know that Moshe didn't bring any food up. And they wait and they wait and they wait. And at a certain point in time, they realize that it's impossible. He must have died. He went up without any food. He's not going to bring down these tablets. What are we to do? We need something towards which we could focus our attention.
Why didn't, if that was the case, they should have acted far sooner than 39 or 40 days.
He actually makes that point. He says, if you see how remarkable it is that they made it for 40 days. Be that as it may, you could say the same approach within Rashi's position as well. He also notes, as you pointed out, that this was a small minority of the population, and there was a debate exactly what to do. And he continues, their sin, therefore, was the making of an image which was forbidden to them. They further sinned by ascribing divinity to something which they themselves have constructed. Now, let me explain this. The problem then was not that they weren't serving God. They certainly were serving God. Chag LaHashem Machar. They didn't attribute divinity to the image. They believed in God. But this was a way of focusing their attention upon God. So what was so bad about it? What was so bad was that this violated the Torah, because the second of the Ten Commandments says that you may not make a graven image. And that was the problem. In fact, there are some who comment that if you look at the Parshios after Parshas Kisisa, Vayakel and Pekudei, so they keep on saying, as God commanded to Moshe, as God commanded to Moshe, because what made the Mishkan justified was specifically that it was commanded. Was it not commanded, it would have been idolatry. This was idolatry not because they didn't serve God. It was idolatry because God said, this is not a legitimate form of service. And
what the God declares, you know, you can have images in Judaism, mm-hmm. prove them on the Aron.
Exactly.
Graven images.
Exactly. And the difference between the Kruvim and the Egel was only that one was commanded and one was not. And he continues, we don't have time to read the whole thing, along these lines. Similarly, the Ramban on your source sheets on page 4, again, I'll present it outside, but he says, if you look at the verses, it's clear and obvious that they were looking for a replacement for Moshe. They weren't looking for a God. And they turned to Aaron. And what did Aaron do? So where did they get the idea of a calf? So the Medrash points out a fascinating thing, that they were in a inhospitable environment, and the din in the world comes from the north. That's because in the Torah's directional system, Kedem, or east, is facing forward, such that din or harshness is to the left, and to the right is mercy. On the Kisei HaKavod, on the left side, or the north side, is the shore. And they looked, as it were, they had some type of image of the divine chariot that they experienced at Sinai, and they were looking for that power, and Aaron realized that power for guidance in this inhospitable and dangerous environment in the Midbar would be through the Koach of the Shur. Now clearly Maaseh Merkava has deep secrets which we don't understand. But somehow or another, it was actually from the very experience of Sinai that they understood that somehow or another, by tapping into the power of the Shur, they would be able to experience some type of divine guidance and revelation as to how to make it through the Midbar. And that's what they were doing. They were looking to replace Moshe. Until now, they had understood and learned the way to go through the Midbar from Moshe. And now, since they believed Moshe was dead, they thought, well, we're going to use this Egel, so we're going to offer sacrifices to God, not to the Egel. And through offering sacrifices to God and focusing our attention on this Egel, we will somehow or another be able to receive the direction and the guidance from God and thereby go safely on our journey. Now here we have to, again, we could elaborate on this point. Yes?
According to the Kuzari, the replacement is not for Moshe, but for the Amud Anan.
Nachon. That's a difference.
Or the Luchot.
Yes, correct.
Not for Moshe.
You're correct. That's a difference between the Ramban and the Kuzari. Mm-hmm. The Ramban focuses more on Moshe, and the Kuzari focuses more on
tablets
and on the tablets, on something to focus on and thereby receive. Yes. So as I said, the Ibn Ezra says it a third way. The common denominator is they were looking for something more concrete, but to meditate upon. But it wasn't true idolatry in that sense. Now, let's go back to the.
You can look today also. You know, there are a lot of rabbis.
Mm-hmm.
People look. They are like they are God. You know what I mean? They're like.
Yeah.
They kmiot and.
The line between legitimate service and idolatry is very fine at times, and it's crossed exactly as you're pointing out.
Also, was it Nadav and Avihu Isara?
Right.
That's a form of creativity.
Yes, exactly. So let's go back to the question we asked a couple of minutes ago, and that's another example: the Isara, Nadav and Avihu, which is we talked about before how there is room for creativity and individuality in the service of God, and we're encouraged to serve God creatively and individually. Well, in light of what we've just seen, the terrible sin of the Egel Azav was one of creativity in the service of God. That's what it was. They tried to serve God creatively in a way other than that which the Torah explicitly stated. And of course, that service of God, that creative service of God, is nothing other than idolatry, a sin for which we still suffer from today. So doesn't the...
Like
you said, exactly, Eshara, Shelot Tziva. So does that tell us that there's no room for creativity in the service of God? Put it differently, what's the difference between Kabbalah Shabbos and the Egel Azav? Right. We said before that Kabbalah Shabbos is an example of creativity, of individuality, in which is, of course, very, very positive. The Egel Azav was something very negative. So what's the difference? Why is one Avodah Zarah and one something positive?
One is within the constraints of the Torah. And the other
okay,
is
excellent. So the most basic distinction is exactly what you're saying, namely that it has to be within the constraints of the Torah. The case of the Esh Sarav Nadav Naviyu, or the case of the Egel Hazav, violated the Halacha, violated the Torah. It might have seemed like a good idea, but the Torah said no. So when, obviously, the first test, whenever someone is considering some form of innovation that must be considered, is does it actually violate the Torah? Is it within the spirit of Torah? Or is it against the spirit of Torah?
That differentiates Navi Sheker and Navi
It's very difficult because generation after, you know, Chachamim interpret Torah.
Mm-hmm.
So I can think that more than 100 years, someone will say that also Kabbalah Shabbat violate something.
It's true, and sometimes it's not easy. Another difference, and again, we could spend an hour on this question, is the extent to which it's rooted within tradition. Kabbalah Shabbos may have been an innovation, but if you go back to the Gemara, the Gemara talks about stories of how the Tanayim and the Amoraim would go out and greet Shabbos. It wasn't just something that made up. It incorporated Tehillim and the like. So while it was innovative, it was within a tradition. And this goes back to what we were talking about before, that something could be a Chiddush, it could be Chadash, but at the same time, it could also be Namra L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. And it must fit in within the tradition and be rooted in the tradition for it to be legitimate and justified. There are certainly many further differences, but something to think about for the Shabbos.
Some people say the whole purpose of Vayakhel Pekudei being there, even though you already have all the information from the Tzaveh, just so that it could say Kasher Tzivah Hashem Es Moshe, to emphasize.
Exactly. All right. Everyone should have a wonderful Shabbos and a great week. I'll see you, God willing, next time.
Also, the whole evolution of the Nusach we have at Tefillah Shacharis wasn't always there. It evolved. Mm-hmm. I think according to